The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Baptist News Global, United Methodist News, ICT News, and the Religion News Service. Our first article was published in the Christian Century, but originally written and published by Baptist News Global writer Mark Wingfield. The SBC educates 1 in 5 seminary students. All 6 of the Southern Baptist Convention seminaries remain in the top 10 latest theological schools in the U.S., according to new data from the Association of Theological Schools. With a combined headcount enrollment of 13,471 students in its 6 seminaries last year, the SBC was training 18.8% of all seminary students nationwide. Even the Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas, despite its recent financial and enrollment challenges, remains one of the largest seminaries in the nation, by both headcount enrollment and full-time equivalent enrollment. For decades, SBC schools have dominated a theological education market that's populated mainly by smaller schools of a few hundred students. For the 2023-24 academic year, only 16 seminaries in the U.S. reported a total headcount enrollment of more than 1,000. And only 11% more reported a total headcount of 500 to 1,000. That means only 12% of the 237 U.S. schools affiliated with the ATS enrolled more than 500 students. When it comes to FTE enrollment, an average calculated by headcount enrollment adjusted by what counts as a full-time load, only 6 schools in the U.S. reported more than 1,000 students, and another 14 reported 500 to 1,000. Together, they accounted for 14% of all ATS-accredited schools in the U.S. Among the SBC schools, the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville is the largest. It took that title away from Southwestern, which in the 1970s and 80s billed itself as the world's largest theological seminary. The ATS data did reveal changes in the U.S. religious landscape, including the rising influence of non-denominationalism. For example, 30 years ago, Dallas Theological Seminary, a non-denominational school tied to the Bible Church movement, reported a headcount enrollment of 1,221 and an FTE enrollment of 752. Last year, DTS ranked as the 4th largest seminary in the country, with a headcount enrollment of 2,651 and an FTE enrollment of 1,400. Few other seminaries have doubled their enrollment in the past 30 years of general decline in theological education. DTS is as theologically conservative as any of the SBC seminaries and espouses a premillennial dispensationalism that is widely accepted in SBC seminaries today. The largest U.S. seminary by far is Liberty Theological Seminary in Lynchburg, Virginia, with a headcount enrollment of 5,507 and FTE enrollment of 4,050. Now an article that was published in the Christian Century in October, but written by Jim Patterson of the United Methodist News. DC Church wrestles with J. Edgar Hoover connection. The association between Jesus and longtime FBI Chief J. Edgar Hoover comes up frequently at Capitol Hill United Methodist Church in Washington, D.C. There's a huge stained glass window of Jesus in the sanctuary. A plaque nearby dedicates the window to Hoover, who headed the FBI and its predecessor agency from 1924 until his death in 1972. The church parking lot sits on the property where Hoover was born and lived for many years. Yes, the same Hoover who allegedly possessed files of embarrassing photos and reports of government officials and other victims as insurance to keep him in his position. The plague signals to me, the plaque signals to me that you agree that J. Edgar Hoover is a good model for Christian virtues, said the church's pastor, Stephanie Vader. Because otherwise, why would you have it up there? The congregation plans to address the situation and hopefully reconcile it with a September 29 rededication ceremony for the window to distance it from Hoover. The original plaque will be moved elsewhere in the church, along with an explanation of the circumstances. There was a dedication ceremony in 1966, which Hoover himself attended, along with multiple white bishops, because we were segregated conferences at the time, Vader explained. The September event is meant as a counterweight to that June 26, 1966 ceremony. According to an account by Gail Monroe, the church's archivist, the dedication service featured sermons and prayers by prominent white clergymen who stated that Hoover merited being honored because of his dedication to Christian virtues. The Reverend Edward Lewis, the pastor of CHUMC, preached on the scripture passage about the divine calling of the prophet Samuel, who helped turn the nation of Israel back to God from sin and idolatry, Monroe wrote. Reverend Lewis said that Hoover was a modern Samuel who had heeded God's call to turn America away from subversion and back to God. That's high praise for a man whose legacy has since been questioned. Hoover gets credit for advancing the FBI technology-wise, but some of his activities were suspect or outright illegal. The FBI was spying on student groups and women's groups and civil rights groups, and not for crimes committed or alleged crimes, but really for their political beliefs, said LaRon A. Martin, a professor at Stanford University, and author of The Gospel of J. Edgar Hoover, How the FBI Aided and Abetted the Rise of White Christian Nationalism. Today's Christian nationalism movement traces directly to Hoover, Martin said. In a webinar for Capitol Hill UMC he presented earlier this year, Martin quoted Hoover as saying in 1961 that the FBI has a Christian purpose to defend and perpetuate the dignity of the nation's Christian endowment. When Hoover took over the FBI, he was deliberate in making it reflect his white Christian nationalist views, Martin said. He got rid of all the women who were special agents and all of the men of color as well. He hired exclusively white Catholic and Protestant men to be FBI agents and to be the leadership of his FBI. Hoover also used information the FBI collected to pressure politicians and others, Martin added. There are documented reports of when the Senate would have to vote for appropriations that Hoover would send an FBI agent to a congressman and say, "We received these photos of your wife doing this," or "We have reason to believe that you're doing this, and we just want you to know that we're aware of the situation, and we're taking care of it." All of which makes the plaque recognizing Hoover as a good model for Christian virtues problematic. "It is the biggest focal point in our sanctuary," Vader said. "It's the biggest window. It's huge." Discerning how to address the issue has been a lengthy process, said Tamara Roundtree, a member of the church, and part of its racial justice ministry band. "This is a very sensitive topic, and I don't think we should be rushed or shoved down people's throats," Roundtree said. "I'm big on educating people and making sure they understand things, So we wanted to give the congregation as much voice in this as possible. It's been very deliberate. The church's racial justice ministry band meets monthly to discuss the window plaque and other racial issues. Among other activities, the band started a program to pay royalties for black spirituals sung at the church. This year, the money went to the local Duke Ellington School of the Arts. The willingness of white members of Capitol Hill UNC to address the issue is significant to the church's black members, said church administrator Xavier Hodge. We're all in the same place, that we don't want to be known as a place that honored someone who did so many bad things, he said. The issue isn't whether to forgive Hoover, Vader said. We can forgive him and still take the plaque down, she said. Now an article published by the ICT News, written by Renata Birkenbuehl. Catholic boarding school documents staying in Montana. In a significant turn of events, an array of documents related to Catholic boarding school students from several indigenous nations will remain in Montana. Several U-Hauls loaded with everyday records, photos, ledgers, scrapbooks, and other archives were originally slated for transfer to Boston. It's considered a win for tribes whose children attended the former Ursuline Academy in Great Falls, Montana, starting in 1912. Keeping the archives in the Great Falls History Museum allows easier access for area descendants researching their families. Having a centralized repository with access to family historical records would be of the greatest value to all who desire to learn about their extended families, religious affiliations, births, deaths, and life circumstances, said Steve Lazar, Confederated Salish, Kootenai, and Pendereya, in a statement. Lazar is a member of the Montana Historical Society's Board of Trustees and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribal Council. The original keepers of the records, the Western Province of the Roman Union Ursuline Sisters, reportedly expressed relief at discovering a local professional entity willing to safely preserve the documents for current and future Native generations. They seem to readily agree that truth-telling is very important, said Christy Scott, director of the History Museum. And because they didn't live during the time of the missions, the best they could do is to tell the truth, to make the records available. According to a record released in July, Catholic sisters in the U.S. ran 74 government or church-built boarding schools across 22 states. Both in a statement to Scott and in a 2023 report, the Ursuline sisters acknowledged their role in the breaking down of Native American culture, traditions, and language. The Roman Union Ursuline Sisters of the Western Province have long lamented the suffering caused by Native American boarding schools and the generational trauma that continues to this day with so many others, said Diane Balmuck, the Western Province leader. We continue to take a hard look at the issues of racism in our country and our part in the harm that colonialism played in our own history. Four Ursuline sisters, two from California and two from Montana, had originally visited Great Falls in June 2023 to discuss the future of the archives with an unidentified tribal member looking for relatives' boarding school history. But when that contact did not show up, Scott intervened. I spent close to 4 hours with the nuns having coffee, discussing the records, she said. After the sisters' Eastern and Central provinces moved their archives to the Jesuit-run Boston College, the Western Province was on track to join them. But the chance meeting with Scott proved fateful for entire swaths of tribal descendants in the region. The significance of this collection to our neighboring tribal nations cannot be overstated, Scott said. For over 100 years, this collection has been cared for and maintained by the Ursuline Western Province, yet was quite challenging to access. We are honored to provide a neutral ground for discovery of these archives. Scott said that, as part of a long-term agreement with the Ursulines, her staff will preserve, catalog, and digitize the records in a climate-controlled environment. The goal is to make the archives available first to the tribes by January 2025, and then to the general public sometime in 2026. Now an article published by the United Methodist News, written by Jim Patterson. After years of struggle, the UMC's only black seminary is finding its future. The day before a ribbon cutting for a new student lounge at Gammon Theological Seminary in Atlanta, the rest of the building was still a work in progress. Brown builders' paper covered floors, plastic tarps protected walls, and furniture in piles of boxes were waiting to be unpacked in unpainted rooms. Leading a tour of the compact campus in her trademark high-top Converse sneakers, Candace M. Lewis, president of Gammon since 2021, clearly saw things others hadn't envisioned. "Whenever God gives vision, there's provision," Lewis said. "We have more than enough vision to go around, and as we share vision, I feel like that really does invoke generosity." Lewis and her small staff are reinventing the only historically black United Methodist seminary by offering new courses and seeking new sources of funding. And after more than six decades of being accredited through the Interdenominational Theology Center, Gammon is now going through the process of getting its own accreditation through the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools. The ITC, a consortium of historically black schools, declared financial exigency in April 2023, indicating a severe financial crisis. The ITC includes the Morehouse School of Religion, as well as schools associated with the Christian Methodist Episcopal Church and the Church of God in Christ. Lewis said she never could have anticipated the ITC's financial situation. "That just felt like the bottom was falling out of the school," she said. "But what I learned in that process is that in every crisis, there's an opportunity." Because of the declaration of exigency, Gammon was forced to transfer all of its students to other institutions to finish their degrees, which Lewis said was the lowest point. "So we had to settle down and be prayerful," she said. "Ask the Lord, what is the opportunity in this crisis?" So now, 18 months later, we're getting ready to launch as an independent school. Renita Weems, a respected biblical scholar, teacher, theologian, and author, has come aboard as chief academic officer, a position the ITC used to provide. Weems said revitalization efforts are helped by Gammon's rich history of producing black clergy and leaders. "There are students, United Methodist, but also non-United Methodist, who are interested in attending a historically black theological institution," Weems said. "So I think there's a market." Like the other 12 United Methodist seminaries in the U.S., Gammon is getting less financial support from the denomination's Ministerial Education Fund due to a reduced budget and the disaffiliation of about a quarter of U.S. churches following conflicts in the UMC over LGBTQ inclusion. From 2016 to 2023, the UMC scaled back its support of Gammon by nearly half, from $728,034 to $367,513. According to the United Methodist Board of higher education and ministry. Gammon gets the least support of the 13 United Methodist seminaries in the U.S., primarily because the number of students and ordinations are large considerations in the funding formula. For the fall 2024 semester, Gammon has only about 20 students, Lewis said. Former Gammon president Alfred L. Norris said this funding formula has to change in order for Gammon to remain one of the UMC-affiliated seminaries. We're always smaller, he said. There has to be some attention given to the fact that we are still a viable seminary in the United Methodist Church, and therefore we need more support from the church, because we can't get the kind of support from other sources that we need. Lewis estimates Gammon has 3 to 5 years to raise enough money to be self-supporting. A big part of the president's job is seeking partnerships and contributions to get there. A multi-million annual fund campaign is being prepared to launch in the fall of 2025 or spring of 2026. The monetary goal has not yet been set. Lewis believes, as a change agent with an established record, she is the right person for the Gammon job. If you look at my ministry track record, I've always been an innovator, she said. The Florida Conference hadn't started a new African American church in 20 years. So, right out of seminary, that was my first appointment, to start a church. That church is now 27 years old, and it's still going. Lewis also worked for Path One, a branch of United Methodist Discipleship Ministries that innovates and equips church leaders to start and sustain new and vital congregations and ministries. Now she was back at Gammon, her alma mater. The school really needed a type of leader that could give them more options related to the future, and I'm gifted in visionary transformational leadership, she said. Already, Gammon has started offering hybrid online and in-person classes. And next year, Gammon will launch an online certificate program for topics like womanist and liberation theology. A Center for Latino and Latina Studies is being planned for possible launch in January 2025. In the future, Lewis said she'd love to use scholarship funds to offer every student a 50% tuition discount. So I'm going to be hitting the streets hard this fall, she said. That's why I got my tennis shoes on, because I'm going to do a lot of running, a lot of walking, because I've got to build some strong partnerships. Last of all, we have an excerpt from an article written by Religion News Service writer Catherine Post and entitled, Springfield Faith Leaders Stand with Haitian Immigrants. Jesus said that he is the way, the truth, and the light. Jesus is with us in truth, and the truth is that Haitians are not eating pets in Springfield, said Senior Pastor Carl Ruby, gripping the pulpit of Central Christian Church in Springfield, Ohio. Moments later, the 60-person congregation rose to its feet, applauding the 5 Haitian community leaders who were visiting on September 15. We love you, Ruby said to them. We're glad you're here. Earlier in the week, the small non-denominational church hadn't been certain they would be worshiping on Sunday. Bomb threats and the presence of hate groups had the city on edge, but the board voted to meet. And Ruby took the opportunity to appeal to both President Biden and former President Trump. I call on our former president, President Trump, out of the goodness of his heart, out of the divine spark of God's image that lives in every human being, to let people know that he was misinformed about what's happening in our community, and to ask hate groups who are here to leave, said Ruby. He also called on President Biden to provide additional resources to support the expanding city, which has seen an influx of as many as 20,000 Haitian immigrants in the past decade. The appeal came after the Midwestern city was thrust into the national spotlight following the September 10 presidential debate, when former President Trump claimed Haitian migrants are eating the pets of people that live there. Since then, the debunked pet-eating line has become a memeified punchline. But for community members, the effects of the remark have been no joke. Two schools, two hospitals, Springfield City Hall, and Clark County offices were all closed in the wake of bomb threats. Anti-immigrant flyers claiming to be from the Trinity White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, a Kentucky offshoot of the white supremacist group, were reportedly distributed in Springfield as well. Catholic Charities Southwestern Ohio, which provides legal, interpretive, and case management services in Springfield, but does not resettle immigrants there, has faced verbal and written attacks, Chief Executive Tony Stieretz told America Magazine. "My daughter asked me, 'What's going on, Dad?'" said Harold Herod, an engineer and member of the Haitian Community Help and Support Center, who visited Ruby's church on September 16. "I tried to explain to her the situation, but I don't want to put her in a situation of feeling fear about school." The same Sunday, patrons and cashiers at a Dunkin' Donuts in the south end of the city traded rumors about Haitians being arrested and consuming pets. But later that afternoon, a different narrative unfolded just around the corner, where about 60 Haitians met at First Evangelical Haitian Church of Springfield for a weekly English Speakers of Other Languages course. Normally, the classes are stretched to find English-speaking conversation partners, but this week, about 30 volunteers, many of them from local churches, participated. "I am with you in the difficulties," the Haitian students practice speaking in English. At the end of the event, the English speakers distributed flowers and baked goods, while Haitian leaders thanked them for their solidarity. "We are in amazement at how much good is coming out of this difficulty," said Heidi Earlywine, an English teacher and advocate who coordinates the ESOL courses. We have run out of time, excuse me, for today's episode of Religion in the News. I hope you'll listen again next time and that you've enjoyed it. I am Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.